It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Yeah, my name is Derek. I'm here in so-called Southern Oregon and have lived experiences of voices and visions and also kind of the mental health system in a variety of different ways, and have also been involved in trying to create and imagine alternatives to that kind of system, both in individual lives as well as kind of cultural and systemic and social movement ways. So
great. Yeah, and the way this started was that you're the author behind two pieces, Madness, Disability, and Abolition. One kind of gets into a critique, and then one starts to flesh out different alternatives. And we're going to be talking broadly about those two pieces and kind of the questions that they raise. But how did you start writing about madness and how this connects with abolition and everything else?
Well, it's been something near to my heart for a long time, but I really started thinking about it during the uprising last year for Black Lives, and, you know, following the murder of George Floyd and Tony McDade and all these others. And I think one of the things I was seeing, I mean, it was incredible, this uprising, really remarkable, and sort of this national conversation around police abolition and what that could look like. And I think within that conversation was tracking the way that the conversations around madness or mental health or alternatives to 911, wellness checks, you know, all this kind of stuff. Just noticing how those conversations were unfolding and wanting to be in conversation with that. And I think in particular kind of push against some of the potential blind spots. I think the, like having police abolition, and I think as well as prison abolition from, you know, groups like Critical Resistance and Angela Davis and folks that have really brought both of these things into the fore of national consciousness. And you know, we've seen prison abolition being talked about a lot too, with everything going on with COVID. And I think it's one out of four inmates having gotten COVID and things like that. But just thinking, okay, well, one of the things we hear around abolition is, well, we need alternatives, we're imagining different worlds. And then the question of how do you relate to people that are experiencing distress or deemed mad or all of these kinds of things, because those are folks that often get murdered by the police or end up in jails and prisons and institutions. And what does it actually mean to, what do our alternatives actually look like? And so those kind of questions are what led to this writing.
Well, let's just kind of dive into it. Lay out some of the main arguments in the first two pieces, starting with the first one, Madness, Disability, and Abolition. What are you mainly addressing in this one?
Yeah, in the first piece, I wanted to talk about the role of and the intersection between state violence and people that are deemed mad and disabled, you know, and or disabled. And you know, like Sins Invalid, one of the disability justice collectives out of the Bay Area, they've said that you know, more than half of the people that are murdered by police are have some kind of disability, right? And I think one of the things that, like, disability justice folks have talked about is the way in which, say, a black disabled man is killed by the police. Folks thinking about racial justice will often emphasize that he was a black man and not mention the disability, and folks that he was disabled, and folks that are in a disability rights world might talk only about the disability and not talk about race at all. And so wanting to tie those things together. And then I think also to be in conversation around the differences between madness and disability. So that statistic, more than half the people that are killed by police have a disability. One of the things about madness is often these are labels that are put on to people. So there's some people can find a certain label or diagnosis or identity to be really meaningful to talk about. But there are other people that, you know, for me personally, like I said, I have lived experience with voices and visions, but I don't identify with any kind of disability or diagnosis. And so if the police murdered me, I actually wouldn't want people to talk about it as if I had a disability. We could talk about it in terms of madness, but, you know, so trying to be in conversation around all of these things and look at the role of state violence as it's occurring in police violence and prisons, but also look at the carceral logic and sort of the tools of violence and coercion and force that are manifest or present in the mental health system. So in the psych ward and in the ways we relate to madness. So I don't know if that's we'll dive more into the specifics of that argument, I guess. And then in the second piece, really wanted to look at, so the first piece is maybe a bit more theoretical, but talking about real life examples of like Elijah McClain being murdered by the police, you know, and for, quote, being in a state of excited delirium, you know, whatever that means, which, yeah, I don't think means much. But in the second piece, wanted to really talk about the actual kind of here and now things that people are doing and the alternatives that people are creating, the autonomous spaces, the peer support warm lines, the trans lifeline that, you know, is for trans and not run by and for trans and non-binary folks in crisis or just who want to talk to somebody. And this is a hotline that doesn't call the cops, you know, so you're not going to call this because you're in crisis and then have the police showing up for a wellness check. And so, yeah, part two was really delving into the specifics of things people are doing and imagining how we might bring some of those alternatives into our own communities.
You know, when the first piece went up, I remember on Twitter, somebody wrote trolling. They said, "Oh, so you just want to get rid of therapy?" And, which was, you know, sort of like a knee-jerk reaction, and I could tell that they really didn't read the piece. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, what exactly is the critique about the modern sort of system?
Yeah, I think it's funny because I don't think either of the pieces mentioned therapy at all. You know, it actually wasn't a part of the conversation. But I think, so the police often, so if someone calls 911 or if a family member calls 911 and says, I want to kill myself, I'm worried that my son wants to kill himself, there's a naked man running down the street, talking to himself, you know, any of these kinds of situations. If you call 911, generally in most communities, what will happen is the police will be the first people to respond to that. They may come with an EMT or paramedics, but often the police are there. And what we see happening all across the country is that a lot of people are then being murdered by the police. And that's especially true for, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color, for trans folks, for unhoused folks. You know, people are being murdered by the police. Like we saw this recently I mean, we see this all the time, actually. But, in Modesto, there was a recent police murdering. In Portland or outside of Portland in the suburbs, we've seen this. You know, somebody calls the cops, say, seeking help for their loved one, or they call 911 and the police come and murder that person. So
literally for a wellness check.
Literally for a wellness check. Yeah, literally for a wellness check. And then one of the other things we see is that, okay, the police come and they don't murder you, but maybe you end up in a psych hold where you're then held down against your will and shot up with antipsychotics and loot. You know, what happens in the psych hold is often also a pretty violent experience. And we've seen studies recently that say forced hospitalization for folks that are suicidal actually seems to increase their chance that they'll try and take their own lives because of how brutal this system is. And, I've seen unhoused folks be hospitalized for a day and sort of beat up by the internal security guards in the hospital because they wanted to die. They were hospitalized for a day, beat up by the staff, and then kicked out in the morning, and they're not feeling better when they get kicked out, So also wanting to talk about the violent experiences that people are subjected to there, there are no national numbers on it, but the number of police shootings or security guard shootings that happen in hospitals is pretty astounding too. So somebody goes to the hospital seeking help and they end up being shot or even murdered by the armed guards that are in the hospital. It's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, and a recent example in my own life, a neighbor was suffering from Alzheimer's, and we were talking to people around. It's like, what can we do? Because I mean, they were basically just like losing it slowly, and it getting worse and worse. And we called essentially like Adult Protective Services, and they responded by saying, "Well, you've got to call the police." And yeah. It's like, aren't you the people that are supposed to help them? Like, you're the agency that's like designed to like deal with this, right? And they basically told us that we had to call the police to the point where the police basically got tired of hearing us, and then they were forced to, like, pass it on.
Yeah.
And, which is just such a ludicrous, way of looking at the situation. Like, you're basically just supposed to, like, poke this bureaucracy until finally it, like, somebody decides to pass the buck. It's just really strange and bizarre.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I mean, one of the things with elder care, there's a movie on Netflix now called I Care a Lot that's about sort of an evil person that takes guardianship over elders and how they're exploiting and manipulating this. And of course, we have Free Britney right now. A lot of people are thinking maybe for the first time about psychiatric guardianship and what that can mean when you can have, Britney Spears being still able to create number one hit records or out, singles or whatever, but not able to manage her own money and everything going on in there. And then that's actually something that, the heartbreak that a mother goes through when their kids get taken away because of some kind of diagnosis is unbelievable.
You did a great job in the piece with this, but how does madness intersect with state violence in our society? We've actually been talking about this a lot. I don't know if you want to expand on this or if we want to just continue forward.
Yeah, I think I mentioned Elijah McClain, and I wrote about him in the piece, and I never met Elijah, but from what, family members have said, was just this brilliant, creative young black man who was walking down the street in Aurora, Colorado. And I believe it was a neighbor. Somebody called 911 because he, was black in their neighborhood and dancing and listening to music. And this sort of dancing and listening to music was perceived by the Karen who called or whoever it was that called. And then again, by the police as aggressive. Right. And so this was used as an excuse to in the moment to put him in a chokehold, and paramedics injected him with a lethal dose of ketamine. And just the other day, an independent panel that, you know, city officials in Aurora are now coming out and saying, actually, there was no legal reason, which there are a lot of awful things that happen legally. But even in this case, there was no legal reason to put him in a chokehold. It was just, this is just state violence playing out. This is just the war on killing people because they're deemed mad is another way to wage war on poor black, brown, trans communities that you know, the United States is endlessly invested in this war. And this is a part of it.
You know, you brought up the whole aggressive thing. I think one of the most interesting points you make in the first essay is this point you bring up where historically you say we're, quote, angry, militant, or belligerent people of color, especially black, were seen as having mental illness. And there's actually some examples you use in, like, scientific papers and stuff that are, really are not very old. Like, I think it's from the 60s or 70s. Can you dive more into this kind of like science basically assigning mental illness to people that are angry or belligerent, of course, that have every right to be under oppressive conditions?
Yeah, totally. I think this is a really important topic. And I think, I mean, even the history of kind of so-called mental illness has roots in eugenics. I mean, the idea that there's this illness, you know, here and now we kind of hear a lot about mental illness is like diabetes, you know, this kind of idea. And it's, there's something defective with the person. And we've seen that as, you know, defectives was a category of people who were subjected to, people who were deemed defective were subjected to forced sterilizations when, you know, at sort of the height of American eugenics. And one example where one really tragic and horrific example where that played out was at the Hiawatha Asylum for Insane Indians, where, if a Native or Indigenous person was deemed defective by, you know, in whatever way that means, right? Like, this isn't, they talked back or whatever it might be. Then they were sent to this, this was the National Asylum in the era of, this was in the era of American asylums where there were hundreds or thousands of people living in them, and the asylums had their own graveyards. And, specifically at the Hiawatha Asylum for Insane Indians, because the people there were labeled defective, they could only be released once they were sterilized. So it was part of culling the sterilized, this eugenic, horrific logic that runs through our country's history and so many, and kind of colonialism and at Hiawatha at the asylum. So there was no doctor that could perform a sterilization. And so it meant that just about everyone died there. You know, later in more recent examples, we see in the 1950s, there's a book, Protest Psychosis, which is written by Jonathan Metzl, who's a Vanderbilt professor. And, you know, so it's quite rooted in sort of traditional scientific literature and things like that. And, you know, Jonathan traces out in the book Protest Psychosis, he traces out this way in which the diagnosis of schizophrenia went from being a diagnosis that was primarily given to white housewives in the 1950s. And I think part of we also see this war on women where, like, there are women who are institutionalized because they wanted to change religions from their husband and things like that. So we see it being a tool to kind of keep housewives in check. You know, if they're not working, maybe they're mad or something like that. And then in the 1960s, we see the DSM, the manual that's used to diagnose mental disorders and all this kind of thing. The DSM undergoes a a revision of category. The diagnoses are undergoing revisions, right? And so they're adding in new elements. And we see schizophrenia become, we see these traits of aggression become part of the hallmark of this diagnosis of schizophrenia. And this happens simultaneous to the rise of civil rights. And so then, you know, one way or another, we see this shift from schizophrenia being a diagnosis given to white, you know, middle class housewives to being given to especially black men and, you know, and black urban men. And we see these we see these advertisements, literal advertisements in medical journals that have a picture of a black man with a raised fist, you know, wearing a leather jacket, and there's an urban landscape behind him, and it says, "Angry and belligerent, we can help," you know, and this is the ad. And so there's this literal targeting of people of color in all of these different ways. And of course, if someone is, you know, you think about a diagnosis like paranoia, if sort of the official party line of a government is, "We're benevolent, paternalistic, here to save you," and someone says, "Actually, this government's out to kill me," then, you know, does that, when does that get labeled paranoia, and why does that get labeled paranoia? And I think it's important to say that distress is real. So I'm not arguing against people have difficult experiences, and some of those experiences can be because of, I mean, it can just be scary to hear voices, right? But it can also be you're hungry, the cops are constantly harassing you, constantly harassing your community. People are being murdered by police in your community. That also creates distress. So I think, I'm not saying that distress isn't real, but I think these diagnoses and the ways that we talk about them are certainly, they're very intricately tied in with racial capitalism and the narratives of colonialism and all of these kinds of things, and are used as tools. Diagnosis is used as a tool to, once someone is labeled schizophrenia, regardless of, you know, who they are or what's going on. Like if the police say, "Yeah, we had to kill, we came to a schizophrenic man, and we had to kill him, you know, he was being angry." No one really thinks twice about that. They're like, "Oh, well, if he was schizophrenic, he was probably X, Y, and Z or whatever," you know? So, giving someone this diagnosis some people find diagnosis very helpful, but it can also be a stepping stone. It can be a part of the state violence, actually.
You know, in the text you bring up psychiatry, and I feel like a lot of people, when they hear that, the first thing they think about is Scientology. And I'm just curious, you know, not to spend so much time talking about Scientology, but, you know, what is the anarchist critique of psychiatry, and how is that different than other things that have critiqued it in the past?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that Scientology took on anti-psychiatry in their partnership with Thomas Zaz and all this, and it's not an association that's helpful to the cause, you know what I mean? So I'm certainly not a Scientologist. I'll just make that clear. But I think, I think an anarchist critique of psychiatry ties into what is the role of the state in psychiatry? What is the relationship of the state and psychiatry? What is the relationship between racial capitalism and psychiatry? How are the choices when someone is going through a rough time, their options of that are available to them are informed by racial capitalism, right? Like it's the choice between calling 911 or checking yourself into the psych ward, like that came to be through a set of causes and conditions, you know. And I think also when we think of an anarchist critique of psychiatry, we should also talk about the role of community and how communities can do something different than this, this sort of psychiatry and state-based partnership. And also, I think a lot of this ties into how we support choice and autonomy, both in individuals' lives as well as communities that don't want, that don't want to be murdered by the police when they're having a rough time, or have a different ancestral understanding of what voices and visions mean, or as is really common in Mexican culture and, Chicano culture, to be in contact with loved ones who've departed. This is not a sign of an illness. This is something else. This is being in contact with one's family. And so I think all of these, things are actually what we're talking about, is what are alternatives to state violence and coercion and force, and how can we tend to our hearts and minds and communities in ways that are different.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you want to support It's Going Down, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly, or give us a one-time donation through the site or on Bitcoin. Please support Autonomous Revolutionary Media and help us grow into 2021. Thanks a lot for listening. Let's get right back to it.
Well, just moving forward, let's talk now about sort of the second piece, which talks about alternatives. And broadly speaking, what does an abolitionist approach look like to these topics that we've been raising?
Well, I think that's an open question, and I wouldn't want to put myself as an expert on it. I think if anything, I'd like to be in more conversation around this. What does an abolitionist approach look like? And I think, folks like, again, going back to folks like Angela Davis, or, prison abolitionists that talk about, the role of imagination and what this means. But I do think that questioning the carceral logic, the sort of tools of violence and coercion and force that so often are the default responses to madness or disability and things like this. And I think that then ties into supporting people to make their own decisions, supporting communities to feel empowered, looking after one another. That we don't need these so-called experts to come and save us, because often the expert might actually come and kill, murder us or any of these kinds of things. So thinking about how do we support individuals and communities to make their own decisions around how they relate to distress, and also just how they relate to their inner experience, because there's a lot of people that say hear voices or have visions that actually the suffering that they've experienced is because of the way other people treat them, rather than the content of their actual voices or visions or things like that. So that's the broad picture, I think.
I'm curious if you can give us any examples of what these ideas put into place might look like. I know, I've heard of something in Eugene called Cahoots, which is sort of like an alternative to calling the police, where people can call this group and they kind of do community response to mental health stuff. I know in Oakland right now they're in the midst of launching an alternative to dialing 911, which would call the police. And instead it would call a community response team. I'm curious, are there any other projects that you're aware of? It doesn't even have to be kind of in that vein, but anything that's kind of in dealing with the stuff that we're talking about that you're aware of that people should kind of be looking at.
Yeah, totally. I think that I mentioned the Trans Lifeline earlier, which is a a phone line by and for trans and non-binary folks that people can call when they're, for connection or in distress or to talk to, it's peer run. So talk to folks and get some support, and Trans Lifeline doesn't work with the police. And so you're not, there are some hotlines that will call the police on you. So Trans Lifeline is not one of them. I think the Anti-Police Terror Project, which also has, I don't know if you were thinking of Macro when you said that, but the Anti-Police Terror Project is in Oakland and Sacramento, and they have their MH First, Mental Health First, which is a mobile crisis intervention team. I don't quite like that jargon, but that's similar to what, in some ways similar to what CAHOOTS is, although the Anti-Police Terror Project is black led and I think just comes out of a different community thinking about a different, different ways to respond. And the Wildflower Alliance is another really great group and community, and they run, one of the things they have is a FIA, which is a peer run respite. There are peer run respites all around the country that are alternatives to psychiatric hospitalization. And I think one of the things I think it's important to say about CAHOOTS, I know some folks that are connected to Whitebird and CAHOOTS and things like that. And I think it's great. Part of the vision of CAHOOTS is that they respond to like we're talking about, there's all these calls to 911 that are non-emergency, right? It's not an emergency. whatever you think of as an emergency, it's not, and so CAHOOTS can respond to someone hanging out on a street corner, having a bit of a rough time, and the cops just don't need to go, I do think it's important to say that, like, CAHOOTS grew out of a grassroots, like, CAHOOTS grew out of community saying, hey, let's try this thing out. Let's see how it works. It turns out it works really, really well. And it's great, but I think right now we're seeing state and national legislature that's like, let's create CAHOOTS from the top down. Let's create legislature that then puts in place CAHOOTS. And I think what we'll end up seeing is that these, when the same state legislatures and county mental health departments and police departments get together to create so-called alternatives, they actually end up being pretty similar. You sort of give the social worker a gun and give them a bulletproof vest, and it ends up being pretty similar. So I think that's something we should just continue to be thinking about and aware of, and thinking about what is it, how do we actually push for change in these ways?
You also, in the second essay, you talk about false alternatives, and I'm curious if we can kind of like touch on that. What are some examples of these, and what makes them false?
I think that touches on that. I think one of the things I saw following the uprising last summer for Black Lives was all of these great and I think really, well-intentioned memes and lists and things. Here's numbers you can call instead of 911, and it would put a suicide hotline on there. That suicide hotline, like the many of the national suicide hotlines, call the police. So if they, in their world and language, if they can't contract with you for safety, then they will call the police, and the police will. Or they'll call 911, and the police and the paramedics will come, and they might come and say, have a good night. They might come and take you to a hospital. They might come and kill you. Any of these kinds of outcomes might unfortunately emerge from it. And so I think that's a false alternative, right? If your goal is not calling 911, but then you give someone a number that calls 911, you haven't gotten very far. And I think, it's important to say historically, I mean, we're talking about abolition, and this is this is rooted in abolition of slavery. And so, you know, examples of this that we saw were like after the end of slavery, we saw the convict leasing system. You know, we see these expansions of the police state. And I think when we talk about prison abolition, again, people say we need people who are mad or disabled should not be incarcerated, and then, or they shouldn't be in, isolation, or they shouldn't be in any of these kinds of things. And so, but often the conversation is then, so that's why we need to get them into the mental health system. Let's get them out of prison or jail and into the mental health system. Well, part of what I hope is coming across is the mental health system actually, it can also be a system of violence. And so it's not like, you know, there were social movements, they're largely forgotten from kind of popular American consciousness, whatever that is. But there were social movements that fought against institutionalization for, you know, they fought against these mental institutions. They fought against the institutions that were, incarcerating people for developmental and intellectual disabilities. And, you know, there's a book, Decarcerating Disability, that talks a lot about this. But these are people fought to get out of these, asylums and mental institutions. And so if our way of getting people out of prison is putting them back into those systems, we've just changed the seats. You know, we've just changed the bureaucracy, as you said earlier. We've just changed the bureaucracy that's incarcerating these people. We haven't actually freed anyone.
Every day now you're bleeding through your cuticles, passing through a portal as you're sitting in your cubicle. Isn't life beautiful? I think that life is beautiful. Trying to keep you cool at your grandfather's funeral, finding out eventually the feeling wasn't mutual. You were not invited cause you're nothing like the usual. Isn't life beautiful? I think that life is beautiful. You wanna see your friends but you're stuck inside a hospital. Doctor walks in and he tells you that it's terminal. Tumor in your brain and it's saying it's inoperable. Isn't life beautiful? I think that life is beautiful. They'll kill your little brother and I'll tell you he's a criminal. They'll fucking kill you too, so you better not get physical. Welcome to America, the type of shit is typical. Isn't life beautiful? I think that life is beautiful. Wake up in the morning, now you're doing the impossible. Find out what's important, now you're feeling philosophical. When I die, I'll pack my bags, move somewhere more affordable. Isn't life horrible? I think that life is horrible. You think she's adorable, she thinks that you're intolerable. You think you can do it, but your chances are improbable. Once you feel unstoppable, you run into an obstacle. Isn't life comical? I think that life is comical. And if you ever need a friend, then you got me. And in the end, when I die, would you watch me? And if I try suicide, would you stop me? Would you help me get a grip, or would you drop me? Run away, make friends with the moon. Why you tripping? You'll be with your friends soon. It comes a time everybody meets the same fate. I think I'ma die alone inside my room.
How does autonomous spaces play a role in all of this? I think you brought up maybe one or two, but the creation of like places for people to go. How does that all fit into this?
I think the most kind of remarkable autonomous spaces I've seen are in Western Massachusetts, connected to the Wildflower Alliance, where there are in multiple of the counties out there in Western Mass. So I think in Springfield and Holyoke maybe in Greenfield as well. And there are these community spaces where people can come and use a computer, get some food. There's groups like Alternatives to Suicide where people can talk about, you know, being suicidal or things like that. They're peer run. They're run by people who have their own they're not clinical spaces. They're run by people who have their own experiences of madness or distress or mental health diagnosis or living on the streets or all this kind of stuff. And they're genuine community spaces. So it's very different than, there's no paperwork. There aren't people taking notes on you. You know, there aren't all of these kinds of things that happen in the mental health system. It's like, no, come hang out. We've got some art materials. Come make some art, you know, whatever's going on. And, I think that kind of thing is really, remarkable. Here in Southern Oregon, we're experimenting with, you know, this year in Southern Oregon, and the city of Medford, failed to open, emergency warming shelters for folks, you know, living on the streets or who need to get warm when it's cold and snowing or raining or any of these kinds of things. And, you know, the CDC says that these things should not be shut down right now. And we've had wildfires and there's kind of seemingly a record number of people on the streets, but Medford decided not to open shelters this year. And so a few of us, at a grassroots level have just created an outdoor COVID safe mobile warming space. And we talk a lot about, you know, ostensibly and kind of we're there for people to come get a cup of coffee or get warm or have community. And so, you know, we end up with folks that are having a rough night and in distress or just need a place where they can be themselves or whatever might be going on. And so I think that's another, it's not our explicit, sort of mission, but it's certainly very woven into what we're doing and how we're doing it and things like that.
Awesome. Yeah. I think I saw a tweet about that online, about the warming center. That's
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. We tweet occasionally, but yeah, tweets go out through Siskiyou Rising Tide for that and on Facebook as well.
In the last essay you write, quote, "We don't need to wait for the entire world to change. We can create an abolitionist future here and now in our relationships, movements, and communities." And what are some ways that radical movements can put these ideas into practice now? If people are listening to this and they want to kind of move on some of these ideas, what can they do and what should they be thinking about?
Yeah, I think that really questioning this idea, I think especially with mental health or madness or, you know, whatever we want to call it, we have the idea that, oh, I'm not qualified to talk to somebody about their voices or visions or their wanting to die, or, you know, this is something that we need an expert on. And I think one of the things that I'm trying to say, and I think the social movements that have come to kind of fight psychiatric oppression and things are like, those experts actually, it's sort of like the, you know, it's the Great Oz. Like they're not actually wearing any clothes. They don't actually, you know, of course they're great and caring and wonderful and people who have degrees and things like that. But there's a lot of this system that doesn't actually know what it's doing any better. And so I think saying, wait, okay, actually maybe I can look after my friend who's going through a rough time. You know, maybe actually we can figure out how to sort of, we've got a few friends here and we can figure out how to just like, they can, you know, they need a place to stay for a few nights. They're having a really rough time. Let's figure out a way to kind of, you could be on our couch tonight. I'll make you a meal. Come on over. And then tomorrow you go to another person's house or, and I think, you know, I think one of the places where this has been really clear, comes into play with, psychiatric medication, where, a lot of people, for one reason or another, again, some of the studies have actually shown that long-term psychiatric medication use is not, is actually less effective than people who decide to come off. And one of the things that can happen with people in their psychiatric medication is if they come off too quickly, if they go cold turkey or suddenly kind of withdraw, then the withdrawal creates a lot of really intense symptoms that cause a lot of problems. So I would never recommend anyone goes off medication cold turkey. And in general, I think people should make their own decisions and with their community and their friends be thinking about these things. I don't have any judgment or belief that taking medication or not taking medication is better. But to say that projects like the Withdrawal Project or the Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Medication, which Will Hall and the Icarus Project worked on, this is one of the places where doctors actually don't know much, if anything, about coming off of medication and how to do it safely and how does a person think about that. And so it's only been through people experimenting and a lot online, communicating with each other, that people have sort of amassed a collective knowledge around that kind of stuff. And so yeah. And then I think, you know, in the piece I talk a bit about too, like Leah Lakshmi and, you know, talking about collective care and what it means to have social movements where people are, you know, there's such a, in our social movements, there's so much burnout. There's so much, you know, we sort of have this idea that people have to be martyrs for the cause and then they might only make it for 5 or 10 years, you know, and then they go back to, you know, sort of watching Netflix or, you know, whatever things people are doing when they drop out of social movements. And so I think also thinking about one, how do we tend to ourselves in social movements and how do we create movement spaces where people can plug in and they use a wheelchair. What is, you know, when we have folks using wheelchairs in our marches, well, they should probably be at the front leading the pace, you know, and also things, how are single parents able to show up in movement spaces? They might not be able to drop everything to go and, you know, fight a pipeline because they've got their kid in school. They can't hop over there, but are we creating ways to keep to, I think folks are always throwing down on these projects. And I think what's happening is that like people actually get pushed out often of movement spaces, you know, sort of white cis able-bodied dudes come and take over and push people out and all this stuff, you know? And you know, so like Sins Invalid, again, the Disability Justice Collective, they've given lists of how to make movement spaces and marches accessible, thinking more through a disability lens. And I think just, it's just being responsive to what's happening in our lives and in our communities and being willing to have our friends' backs and throw down together and figure out what and how we need to do that, you know, I think is kind of the bottom line. And trusting that people who are mad or disabled or whatever, that they actually know what they need. We don't need to go around convincing people that they, if you just listen to the doctor's diagnosis and do everything the doctor says, you'll be okay. Some people love working with their doctors and it's really helpful. But if someone's like, no, that's actually not working for me, it's like, all right, let's figure something else out. And I think tying this, that the individual, I think the revolution really does happen through relationships. So it's, we have to create the world that we want to see and be in. And that happens. I don't think that happens like in some theoretical future. I think that happens piece by piece in community, in relationship here and now.
Awesome. Well, any other thing that you want to touch on or like to add? And also, how can people follow you if possible and reach out?
Well, I'll just say I appreciate making the time and it's been really cool to see the responses of people around this work. And, I think there are people doing this work and thinking about these things and asking these questions all over, and we're and we could do a bit better being connected with one another, you know. So certainly folks are welcome to write me. I'd love to hear from anyone who just wants to say hello, at madresistance@protonmail.com. If folks are interested in the Judy's Midnight Diner, the project I mentioned, the mobile warming space, and what that might emerge into kind of in Medford, you know, Medford, Oregon Mutual Aid Project, folks can follow Siski Rising Tide on Twitter or Facebook. Other stuff, I'm really involved in the Hearing Voices Network, which is for folks that experience voices and visions, and you know, there's other projects which people won't get a hold of me necessarily, but other, you know, another project I'm really excited about is Madness Network News, a new or revived, a new, it's an old an old movement newsletter that's coming back into existence, and the Madness Psychedelics and Awakening Conference. I think I'll be on a panel there soon, or things like that. So, but more importantly, people should reach out to each other. You know, I mean, come say hi to me, but then tell me what's going on in your own town. And I think we should all be doing this work in our own ways, in our own communities, with whatever we've got going on there, and then kind of sharing notes and seeing how it's unfolding is where it's at for me. So
this has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.